Affairs Committee will come to order. It is March 21st and it's 12 p.m. And we have a very tight schedule today. The first item on the agenda is House File 573, Representative Ward's Public Employee Insurance Program. And we have a total of 30 minutes appropriated for this bill. This is the fifth committee that the bill has been heard in. There is only a small part of the bill that refers to the account Minnesota Management and Budget account that is within this finance division's purview. Mr. Morocco from the department is here to answer questions. The discussion should be about finances and not policy of this bill, but I know that it is, I always give wide parameters, and so I have discussed the time schedule with all the committee members, and we see no reason why we can't fulfill my time period today and complete the agenda before 2 o'clock. So that's what we're aiming for. So, Representative Ward.
Chair, thank you, members. Thank you. I'm here before you today to ask for your help with solving a health crisis for our school employees that has prevailed in our state for over a decade. House File 573 provides a solution for rising health care premiums, huge out-of-pocket expenses, very high deductibles, and even total elimination of health care insurance for some school employees. Members, as a former educator of 34 years and negotiator for many teacher contracts, I witnessed firsthand all of these problems. Better statewide health insurance has passed both bodies three times in the past with very broad bipartisan support. House File 573 also has very broad bipartisan support. Members, it passed the past three times in both bodies and then sent the governor because the legislature that time believe there's significant savings due to a large purchasing pool, and we're talking about financing a large purchasing pool that could then be used by school districts for our children's learning opportunities. School districts have experienced huge premium increases over the past two decades. House File 573 will provide long-term stability and predictability for insurance premiums. House File 573 will provide governance that would manage the plan for all the pool rather than having over 300 individually managed plans. School district employees are not healthcare professionals. As they try to make decisions on their own individual plans, sometimes they make some mistakes. The insurance, health insurance pool management can be better understood and undertaken by the State Labor Management Committee, House File 573 establishes. Members, it also is a universal belief contract negotiations would be expedited if health insurance plan was designed and removed from the bargaining table. House File 573, members, is a solution to the years and years of health care crisis for education employees. And members, it can happen now. That will be the end of my testimony today, Madam Chair, because I know you are on time constraints.
I move that House File 573 be recommended to pass. Do you want to take the amendments right away, or do you want testimony first?
Madam Chair, in the past, I'd like to have the testimony first and then the amendments. And Madam Chair, passed and sent Ways and Means Amendment.
That's correct. Ms. Alschweiger.
Madam Chair, I'm Stephanie Jan Alschweiger, Education Minnesota. For bringing this bill forward, we thank Senator Lewis and Representative John Warren for doing this because teachers across the state and educators across the state are really hurting. I just talked to a teacher who's here.
more testimony. I'm sorry. Paul Bourgeois. And he will be followed by Dennis Fent and someone from the School Boards Association. And please keep your remarks very short. Ms. Conley will tell you when your minute's up. But you won't help with that, Representative Ford.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Bourgeois, the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for the Concord Public Schools. I'm here representing the Association of Public School Districts and the Association of School Business Officials along the school district. And of course, this is an important issue because healthcare, if you think about it, is about the only way that you can buy time. So it's a very important item. There are some schools who are in crisis. We agree with that. But many are not. School districts like Sewell and St. Anthony, as large as Rosemount, have done very well in providing for insurance over the last several years. My district, our 3.62% average increase over the life of our self-insurance plan is actually better than the CGIP rate. So, in terms of speaking directly to the financial, I just have two points. One thing is, for the most part, if you look at your own life and your own business, very few of us would enter into a contract that's irrevocable. And with the healthcare exchange coming on, there's going to be opportunities to finish with opportunities to possibly do other health insurance plans that we can lock in, like the Hotel California we opted in, but we can never leave. Finally, on the reserve piece of things, that's going to cost school districts a tremendous amount of money. There will be over $1 billion of claims that are handled every year by this, and there's going to be a huge reserve charge that's going to have to be set up. That reserve charge is going to be into the nine figures, and school districts will have to pay that either over 3 years or other years as it's levied against them. That is going to be significant, and at a time when we've had five instances of major budget cuts across the state, that's going to hurt. So thank you for the opportunity.
Mr. Fent. Miss the School Boards Association. Yesterday somebody from AFSCME 65 I know that AFSCME 65 wanted to register a opposite opinion, they would like to opt out. Members of the committee, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Ward. I'm going to preface this with I like you a lot and I respect you a lot, but so please don't take any of these remarks personal. But okay. So in my mind, this is one of the worst things that we could do. I've talked with many of these folks. I've had both sides in my office. The preponderance of evidence shows that this indeed would cost far more than we need to. I don't know if everybody got it in the packet or not, but I've got a sheet from that was presented to me from one of the co-ops down in my neck of the woods, and I just read you some of these things, but basically, over 92% of this co-op's 24 pool groups elected to remain with their pool or to seek competitive bids elsewhere rather than pay the significantly higher cost of PEAT proposed. And these numbers are staggering. The numbers are staggering. The Owatonna School District had this cooperative's renewal price was $7 million. And the PEAT proposal was $7,700,000, a 10% increase over the top of that. Northfield, 20%, $4,941,000 to $5,948,000, 20% increase. Plainview, $863,000 compared to $1,095,000, a 27% increase. And from what I understand, in fact, Plainview then did elect to go to PEEP, and their premiums rose by 25%. Caledonia, here's a little one that I'm certain that would meet that criteria, because I'm sure their insured pool is less than 1,000. $644,322 as compared to $909,764, a 41% increase. The only one that I'm going to give you here is Medford, and Medford was $851 compared to $831, a 2% difference. So, matter of disclosure, I told you there were, some at least in the pool that didn't. But these are astronomical numbers that we're going to pass on. And, for all of the districts that supposedly, would do so much better, my question is, how many of them have looked to a co-op as a potential to make sure that they can afford and they're passing on something that's good to their employees? We got a limited amount of time. And for me, narrowing it into this, here we're going to do something that's going to have a cost to her budget, the target that she has, that makes no sense at all. This is a bill in search of a problem. I think there are much wiser and better things that we could do than passing this bill today.
Representative Ward.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, thanks for the comments. And I just know of this, that, the service co-ops by far are the biggest opponents of the bill, and for a reason. I understand and I get it. Most of them are have under board superintendents and school board members, and they're they pay back the school districts and dollars from the premiums that are paid by the insured, and use it for not just healthcare coverage, but for other means. So I understand it and I get it. But nobody can predict what their costs for the future are going to be in healthcare. One catastrophic event is going to impact your district significantly. And Madam Chair, I would just like Ms. Allswager to comment on this, on the testimony from Representative Benson as well.
Ms. Allswager. Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I think that you've been given some math, some numbers that have been used with new math or something. Because in Owatonna, when they got their bid, I would love to see it, because in Owatonna, they sought a bid from PEEP. The teachers sought a bid from PEEP. And as a result of the PEEP bid, because it was lower, the insurance insurance company, whoever it was, service co-ops or whomever, lowered their renewal rate by 2% because PEEP, they were threatened by PEEP. And if you look, and I don't have some of the others, I missed the second one that you had. I have the Caledonia contract for the teachers, and it says exactly what the district will contribute to the teachers. And if it goes over, the teachers pay it. The school district does not pay it. So if someone's telling you it's going to cost more, it's not. And finally, you are in the state, in CGIP. Because you have a large, mandatory... mandatory, irrevocable pool that you are in over the 8-year average. The 8-year average is a 4.1% increase. Now, PEEP, first of all, we have teachers who have gone in 4 years ago. Listen carefully to this. In the 4-year average, their increase is less than 1%. Less than 1%. The local impact note that was produced under Governor Pawlenty's administration said it would save $60 million approximately after it's been updated. There is savings in this.
Representative Creechaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll make these quick. Just a couple questions for Ms. Allswager. Just so I understand, would Education Minnesota in any way benefit financially from this? question that you had mentioned, and Representative Ward, I absolutely agree that the health experts are, they're not always in the school districts. But now, are you saying that with the teachers going out, they are now becoming the health experts, that they are out doing the bidding process that we're saying our school finance people can't do?
Representative Ward.
Voluntarily of a sudden you create a pool that is more costly than less costly. So, members, I'd ask that you oppose this amendment just because we need it to be mandatory in order to be cost-effective and efficient.
Representative Leidiger.
Yes, just briefly, I'm going to speak in favor of this amendment. There are so many districts that are out there that are finding great plans. Now, if Pete becomes so good, they will gravitate to this. It should be a voluntary plan. I mean, that's the way competition is. You know, they're going to gravitate to the best plans. You know, I suspect that all of us here used to use the Yahoo search engine. Now everybody uses Google, right? Because it's better. Same thing, same principle with this. Thank you.
Representative
referred to the
University of Minnesota.
And with all due respect, you're talking about providers, Madam Chair.
allowed to opt out. You just said they're fully insured. I think you said fully insured or self-insured. I remember what you said. And I know that I know personally that Stillwater has more than 1,000 insured lives, so they would be able to opt out. If they met all the criteria. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Wills, on your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative Ward that actually leads right into the reason why we need to have it mandatory, because of situations like that. Where the districts shouldn't jump through or have to jump through several hoops to get that exemption. It should be simple. We shouldn't be adding on layers of complicated bureaucracy for them to try to have their own insurance plan that works better for them. So I ask for your support for the amendment.
All in favor of the Wills amendment, signify by saying aye. Ms. Philander, I'm sorry.
Chair Murphy?
No.
Representative Newton?
No.
Detmer?
Yes.
Benson?
Yes.
Bernardi?
No.
Dean?
No.
Howe?
Yes.
Representative Cohen?
No.
Grisha?
Yes.
Driscoll?
Yes.
Purcell?
No.
Swatsky?
No.
Simon? Wills?
Yes.
Any further discussion? Oh, I'm sorry.
7 voting yes, 9 voting no.
Bill. Any further discussion, Representative Grisha?
No question, just a comment. Because we're so rushed and just that Representative Ward, I just want to thank you and for the professionalism in bringing the bill up. I understand what you're trying to do, so.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, all the emails I got on this from my district, what they wanted me to support was the option. So, given that that amendment was not adopted, I'm going to support the school districts in my district and not be able to support the bill.
Madam Chair, when we get to a vote on this, I'd like a roll call, please.
I renew my motion, House Files 573 being recommended to pass, and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Ms. Philander.
Chair Murphy?
Yes.
Newton?
Yes.
Detmer?
No.
Benson?
No.
Bernardi?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Howe?
No.
Kahn?
Yes.
Grisha?
No.
Leidiger?
No.
Nelson?
Yes.
Driscoll?
No.
Purcell?
Aye.
Swatsky?
Yes.
Simon? Wills?
No.
Nine to seven.
Nine voting yes, 7 voting no.
Pardon me?
9 voting yes, 7 voting no.
Representative Ward, the bill is passed to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for the good dialogue and discussion, members.
And thank you for the... Representative Simonson, House File 699. I move that House File 699 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Simon, son, tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Madam Chair, I do have a handout for the page. Gents, firefighters, police officers, and ambulance personnel. This bill would help these local governments recoup the costs incurred during these 15 days to include the backfilling with overtime. For some employers, this becomes a significant cost to the local taxpayers and directly affects those local property taxes. This bill would be specific to reimbursing through a grant program. Those replacement costs for full-time employees, as we discussed, would be reimbursed. The fiscal note in your packet is the second version. I have worked hard with staff to try and refine the costs as best we can, recognizing the need to make some assumptions. And while I know it sounds like a significant amount of money, I think the note reflects a cost of about $1.14 million per year. Do understand, while that this does seem significant, the vast majority of that is currently being assumed by employers such as the City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, City of St. Cloud, City of Duluth, and City of Rochester, larger employers such as that. This bill would provide further local property tax relief to these particular communities and spread the cost of supporting our respective military members across the entire state via the general fund. Madam Chair, I do have one testifier here today, Chris Parsons from the City of St. Paul Fire Department.
Mr. Parsons, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll keep my comments brief try not to repeat what's already been said. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm a 12-year member of the St. Paul Fire Department. I represent 400 firefighters, Secretary of Local 21, St. Paul Firefighters. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters. I just want to be clear that this is a 92-year-old unfunded mandate, and it affects cities. It's not just a St. Paul, Minneapolis, or Duluth issue, but like Representative Simonson stated, this issue affects cities like Rochester, St. Cloud, Bemidji, Faribault, West St. Paul, South St. Paul, among others. When these valuable employees must miss work for training, or deployment, cities are faced with running short-handed or replacing the military member, often via overtime. The cost has been great, and the impact is definitely being felt statewide. A negative latent impact of this bill, or of this 92-year-old unfunded mandate, has been partly to nullify the veterans' preference by causing veterans to be seen as financial liabilities to their cities rather than assets to their departments, as they are. The impact to my city, St. Paul, has been roughly $500,000 the last 2 years. That impact also includes backfilling for military members who are on long-term deployments, which is a different animal altogether and outside the scope of this legislation. I urge all committee members to support this bill. It's an effort to get the state to fulfill its 92-year-old promise by simply amending state statute and enabling the state to make good on its promise. Thank you.
Mr. Kerr or Ms. Roberts, do you want to talk about the fiscal note?
Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. You could provide the fiscal note, Madam Chair. We had to use some assumptions to estimate the cost of the program based on the percentage of Minnesota National Guard members and data we had access to that comprised the whole of the team to establish approximately what number of potential firefighters, police officers, and emergency workers would be impacted. It did come out to, I believe, it was $1.16 million per year as an estimate. We feel it's a good estimate. And we didn't feel that was an excessive amount for the program.
Mr. Kerr, if there was an emergency in any city or county that the National Guard could help with, would they be sent to that city or county? Would some National Guard be sent there?
Madam Chair, the governor directed, so yes.
The governor has to direct.
Well, actually, they consult the point in a life or limb situation, but typically they don't.
Representative Simonson, is your bill aimed primarily? Thank you. Aimed primarily at the days of mandatory training?
Madam Chair, that is correct. This bill is. was specific to the statute that allows or provides for a maximum of 15 days off per year per employee.
Representative
Denver. Now, that answers part of my question, Madam Chair. So it does not apply to the weekend drills.
Representative Simonson.
Madam Chair, Representative Denver, it certainly could. It applies to the 15 days. The employee that is in the military is allowed to have 15 paid days off per year, however they choose to use them. It could certainly be the weekend drills, the annual drill, however they want it to be used, as long as it was approved military leave.
Representative Denver.
Sure, the reason why I say when you're on annual training, you're actually on orders. Whether you're the reserve or the guard, you are on orders, whereas your weekend drills are just weekend drills. You're not on orders. So I'm just wondering how this legislation applies to that.
Representative Simonson.
Madam Chair, Representative Denver, the employee is allowed 15 days off per year with pay to participate in drills, whether they be the weekend drill, the annual drill, or if they're deployed. Say they're deployed in January, the first 15 days of their leave could be leave with pay.
Okay. And Madam Chair. So the 15 days, I understand that. And so if I use my 15 days up with my drills because maybe I'm working nights or whatever, and then I want to take my annual training, which is mandatory in the Guard or the Reserve. So this bill would not cover then that other 15 days of annual training. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Denver, you are correct. They would still be allowed to have the time off. They're mandated to be off. They could be off leave without pay, but this bill would not come into play then.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll try to keep my question short, but I do have a number of them because I spent a long time, a lot of background in this particular law. And some of my concerns are, is this bill, is it specifically for public safety and it doesn't apply to all government employees?
Representative Simonson.
Madam Chair, Representative Howell, this bill references statute 192.26, which talks about officers or employees of the state or any political subdivision, municipal corporation, or other public agency in the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howell.
My concern is you come up with a definition here of public safety employees, and I'm wondering why we single those folks out. Are they the only ones that are eligible for the reimbursement grant? Or why would we define them in this bill?
Representative Simonson.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, we define them in this bill because this is where the majority of the replacement costs come into play. If we have somebody that, you know, works at a desk or within some other position where we don't replace those folks when they're gone, there's no overtime costs incurred, and we believe that across the state it's these positions that we've defined here that generate the most of the overtime costs for the employers.
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, it also reflects the 24/7 nature of fire and police services. A tree trimmer, for example, or somebody working behind a desk Monday through Friday would have their weekends free, be available to serve their commitment to the Guard or the Reserves.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I'll venture to say when they're gone for their annual training, they're not gone just on weekends. But and the intent of the 192.26 was not, and I take issue with that they didn't. It was an unfunded mandate. Really, what 192.26 and the intent of the law was to show other employers how to treat employees that joined the Guard and Reserve, and that was the intent of the law: is to put the state and local governments up on a platform and say, here, this is how you should treat those members that do their duty. It wasn't there to say, hey, we owe you this, we're not going to pay it. It was there to set an example. And I also take issue that cities paid this willingly, because I'll tell you, as a firefighter, I was involved in a 4U lawsuit to get them to define a day and to pay this. So I take issue with it. This is that they came willingly. Since the deployments, they have done a better job because of the
magnetism if you didn't support him. But I will say that this has been a long, drawn-out deal. I think it sets the wrong tone because of the intent of how this was put out there when the bill was first passed, now to say, hey, we're going to reimburse you for this. I think the cities and the employers should do this because it's the right thing to do, not because they're going to get reimbursed by it. Thank you.
Representative Howell, I don't want you to take issue with the bill because, you know, I don't disagree with some of the things that you're saying, but some of those things have happened in the past and they're specific to what's currently in 192.26, our current law. And I want to make it clear to members of the committee that we're not talking about creating a reimbursement program to cover the costs of those employees while they're off on their 15 days. And as I said in my opening comments, employers are fully aware of that and they're paying that. Doing that out of respect to the law, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about this statute over the years because I've been there too. But this particular bill talks about reimbursing the cost of the replacing that person. So when the firefighter goes off on his 15 days and they've got to pay overtime costs to backfill that position, that's what these reimbursement grants are for. This is not for the salary of the employee that's in the military that's off on 15 days.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon, just a couple of questions. And I'm going to piggyback a little off of some of the conversation started by Representative Howe. And the testifier also suggested that because of the nature of public safety and fire and rescue, that's a 24-hour operation. I would put forth that the City of Minneapolis and the City of St. Paul, that streets and utilities are also 24-hour operations. I'm just wondering if how we're using that to define sworn officers or is it municipal employees or are we catching everybody that we want to catch in this bill? And I'll give you my second and you can just can respond to both. And the second item is how about within those 24-hour operations, police and fire dispatchers who may not be sworn officers or other technical support people, how would they be treated under the bill as well?
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. To your first question, there are instances where some public works employees do operate outside of the normal 9-to-5 workday, for instance, snow emergencies. I think City of St. Paul averages about 4 per year. However, when looking at St. Paul Fire Department, for instance, we average about 100 runs a day, and it's morning, noon, night, 2:30 in the morning, we have to be ready. You call 911 in the City of St. Paul, more than not, you're going to get not just a police officer, but a City of St. Paul, either fire ambulance or fire rig. We never close, and we do have the bulk or a disproportionate amount of service members. Given the nature of our work, it tends to attract those types of members. We are a paramilitary organization, and they do very well. They move up through the ranks very quickly, and they are definite assets to our departments. Your second question, and I apologize, you referred to a dispatcher's.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. I'm just talking about the 24-hour services, police, fire, that may have dispatchers or other gate entry personnel or others that are not sworn officers or sworn under oath where you may have in some of these other positions as a peace officer, firefighter, that because it's a 24-hour operation, are we looking, we may have people who are in those roles to support them that are or are not covered by this bill?
Mr. Parsons.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, dispatchers, for instance, would not be covered under this bill. Representative Simonson and I, we definitely understand the fiscal straits that the state finds itself in, and in that regard, we did wish to limit the bill.
Representative Simonson.
To that point, Madam Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll, I would have liked to have drafted this in such a way that we could cover everybody, but it's certainly, I don't think, affordable. In fact, I have in my possession an amendment that includes teachers, but I haven't quite wrapped my head around yet just exactly how we would do that or a for it. So Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. This bill also targets the frontline responders, which is where the need is greatest.
If not, all those in favor of House File 699 being laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Representative Bernardi.
Questions that Representative Benson raised the other day, some of them had to, I believe, were already addressed in current law, and he raised concerns about the ability for challengers to be available, and since this is a polling place, political parties would have the opportunity to have challengers in the polling place during the early voting period. In addition, there were concerns about ballot security, and there are already procedures in rule and statute for ensuring that ballots are secure after they are cast. So I'm happy to answer any questions or anything else. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for some background, there's going to be a couple of other bills that are coming up today, and Representative and Chair Simon's elections bill that we'll be taking a peek at a little later on, we've made a modification in the law that allows for no excuse absentee balloting, and those ballots are requested to the county auditor's office, and in subdivision 5 of section 3, it talks about having to request that from the county auditor's office, so or a designated municipal clerk. And I guess since there's a financial and fiscal note on here, we talked about it, Ms. Frazier, from the state's perspective. Is there any idea how much, how that would impact the local governments and having to do that? I know that in the elections committee was suggested that maybe they'd be open on a Saturday, which could involve overtime for the local communities and the like. And would all communities do that? And what kind of a fiscal impact might that have? If you could just background that for the finance committee, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. We believe, and in discussions with local election officials, believe that the no-excuse absentee voting will have a significant financial impact on local election officials because absentee ballots are about twice as expensive to process as in-person voters. And so increasing the availability of absentee voting will increase the cost because many people who right now don't have a legal reason to vote by absentee ballot go to the polling place will likely choose to cast an absentee ballot instead, which was the experience in Ramsey County when they were allowed to do a pilot project with no excuse absentee voting back in the 80s or 90s. Early voting actually will help defray some of that cost because it would basically mean, at least during the early voting
Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Representative Hansen is correct. This issue has come up before where the disclosure of a secondary residence, the address of that residence, would reveal to the public where somebody lives on weekends or during the summer. Under the economic interest disclosure statute, you do not disclose your homestead, so that's already covered. The case we've had in the past is with a board that includes representatives of law enforcement, state patrol officers, and people like that, and they had concerns, or at least one or two people have had concerns about disclosing their secondary residence address because of safety concerns. The judges, District Court Judges Association came to us with that same concern that certain judges may have threats or fear for their safety if their secondary residence address is disclosed publicly and online. And so this amendment would allow the board to waive that disclosure requirement if they have good cause to do so.
Representative Simonson, or Simons, I'm sorry.
You want me to move the bill or the, yeah, okay. I'll move that House file 136 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And Representative Simons, amendment?
Yes.
A7?
I'll move the A7 amendment as well, which I understand is an opposite.
All in favor of the A7 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any further discussion on the bill as amended? Or on anything Mr. Goldsmith said? If not, all in favor of the Simon motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill is recommended to pass as amended and be referred to Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, was that under five?
Pretty close. Pretty close.
Was to be asked a question for Representative Hansen. I'm just kidding.
Now you're over five.
Thank you.
guess my concerns are less when we're talking about the finance of $135,000. But I know an amendment hasn't been offered, but I actually really like that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Simon.
I want to make clear that that portion of the bill, whether you like it or not, is not before us. That's what we're talking about. So that's not in here. We can have a side conversation about the substance and the merits of the actual proposal, and I'm happy to offline to have a discussion about what you mentioned with respect to the resolution of the bill. Let's just say that bill standalone.
And
Thank you.
discussion around this that we would just, you and I could draft a bill that would just basically say that the next biennium's budget couldn't exceed what the projected revenue was. And if that was the case, then we wouldn't even have a discussion about the, around that.
Of our accounts. Some accounts have
can speak to that. I do know that the governor's office is in discussion with them.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I think we're all fighting colds.
Yes.
I think that's why we're going to have a little break. Mr. Item?
business services will subsidize free services that are able to be issued. Again, point to a few in other states.
Madam Chair, the fee is permanent. It'll continue on.
It wouldn't until the council were to change the fee in partnership with Minn, or if the legislature were to act to eliminate.
Is this a new council?
It would be a new council, the e-government advisory council.
Madam Chair.
Representative Denver.
Why wouldn't it go through the GovOps
committee? Madam Chair. Representative Denver, as I was describing previously, the beauty, I would say, of this proposal is that we're able to bring certain services to bear more quickly and without having to return to the legislature for each particular service fee to be approved. He provided the authority to set one anywhere between $0 and $2. With that. I don't know if I missed your question.
Sometimes there's no beauty in that, and the legislators get smeared because their faces are recognizable. Representative Nelson.
I think what Representative Detmer was asking, by our House rules, anything that creates a new council, and this is a new council, as a mandatory referral to GovOps. We cannot see this in GovOps.
See,
that's what Representative Denver was asking.
Madam Chair, Representative Denver, Representative Nelson, I misunderstood the question. No, this did not go before the GovOps this session, and perhaps the oversight was included in the governor's budget recommendations, but it hasn't been heard as a separate policy bill.
When are you meeting next?
Tomorrow morning. Are you planning to refer this to us tomorrow morning?
We'll have to think about how we can work that out tomorrow or next week. I'm sure there's ways. But thank you for bringing it to our attention. Thank you. Any other questions? A minute. Mr. Mossman, Department of Revenue. Where's he going?
I'm not sure who left me.
He's waiting for his answer. Thank you, Mr. Mossman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. If I understand correctly, I've been asked to just walk through Article 8.
The language bill. Provisions.
The language provisions. So as you may recall, the last time we were before your committee, the department had a number of recommendations that are proposed to save about $4.5 million the next biennium. Some of those provisions do have some language associated with them, three such provisions, and in fact, they're actually the smaller of the provisions from a money standpoint. So I'll start with Article 8 on page 37. Sections 1 and Sections 9 and 10 all relate to a provision that actually has kind of a negligible impact but has the potential to have some fiscal impact, and so it's in our budget recommendations related to the auto theft surcharge. Currently, the Department of Revenue does collect the auto theft surcharge under an interagency agreement with the Department of Public Safety, and what these three sections together, sections 1, just to reiterate, we do actually collect this already for the agency through an interagency agreement. So from the standpoint of the taxpayer and others, it's really a transparent move. We would still do the work that we do.
Please go on.
Madam Chair and members, sections 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 11, and 12 all relate to, section 2. I need to cover section 2 of the bill first. We have a provision that we estimate will save the department a little over $400,000 that relates to when the Department of Revenue collects wage levies, that we be able to require that that be done electronically. Currently, all businesses are, already required by law to file withholding taxes electronically, and so we would use the same e-services system that we already use for businesses that we use to collect withholding taxes to also collect wage levies when there's a portion of wages that are levied on an employee that employers then remit to the Department of Revenue. So this is just an electronic filing requirement. Then, Madam Chair and members, sections 3 through 8 and 11 and 12 deal with a relatively minor provision from a fiscal impact standpoint, but there's a requirement in law right now, and the reason there's a number of provisions here is it's just different tax types. There's a requirement that if you meet a certain threshold, $10,000 of tax liability in the various tax types, that you're required to file electronically. But what happens is you can be above 10,000 some years and below 10,000 other years, and this just tweaks the language in all of those areas so that once you have been required to file electronically because you've met that threshold in 1 year, that you would just always file electronically in later years. So the electronic filing requirement would be ongoing rather than, it actually sometimes now causes confusion because there's a year delay from the liability. You meet the threshold, then you're required the next year. And so once you're in the system for filing electronically, this would have you continuing to file electronically.
What if your computer broke?
If your computer broke, Madam Chair, I would recommend that you call the Department of Revenue, and we would be happy to work with you to find a way to.
And then, Madam Chair and members, the only other section that's in the bill is to is Section 13, which is, there's a repealer provision in Article 8 on page 46. Subparagraph A is a repealer related to the auto theft surcharge because the statutory language is now moved over to the Department of Revenue statutes, so the language in Chapter 168, 8.4 is repealed. And then paragraph B is a repealer that relates to appropriations to the Department of Revenue for the integrated tax system debt service payments, which, as I testified when we presented our budget recommendations, is no longer needed because we were able, through efficiencies, to repay that early. So this removes the appropriations.
Thank you.
The primary changes, as our EBO had already addressed, there was one difference in the what was calculated as reduction to our general fund for the Ambulance Association. We have, I'm going to pass this off to our finance director to explain this.
Ms. Cole.
Madam Chair, for the record, Alicia Cowell of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Just to take a step back, I understand that you had a specific question about how this support our veterans account would work. Is that the question we're addressing? Or
that is a question.
It is a question. So I'll speak to that first.
Okay.
So one of the initiatives we have in the governor's budget is to establish a support our veterans account. And there, how it would work, it would be there would be two revenue streams, which are also revenue from a new veteran's license plate, support our veteran's license plate. And then the second would be from the lottery ticket, which I spoke to earlier. So this would be a new account that would hold those two revenue sources. And then once we have that revenue, we would start a grant program. We would administer and disperse grants to veteran service organizations, kind of grassroots organizations that are responding to emerging needs in the veteran community. So that is high level what the veterans support our veterans account.
And that the total amount of money for those purposes of your grants would come from the license plates and the lottery.
Madam Chair, exactly.
Two different, but not commingled.
Madam Chair, they would be commingled in the new support our veterans account. Revenue from the lottery ticket as well as revenue from the Support Our Veterans license plates would be commingled in a new account called the Support Our Veterans account.
You would be mingling.
Yes, we would be commingling. They would be, the funds would be transferred to us. We would be commingling.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? What about the Governor's Rex and Representative Newton's bill?
Madam Chair, their proposals have some similarities. Both bills appropriate additional funds for the County Veterans Service Office grant program. Both also amend the granting cycle and the qualified uses of the grants. The difference really lies in the amount of money that each county and the Minnesota Association of County Veterans Service Offices would be eligible for in the amount of grants. So the governor's proposal allows each county to be eligible for a base amount of $5,000 each year, plus an additional amount ranging from $0 to $15,000 based on the county veteran population. Representative Newton's bill would allow each county to be eligible for a base amount of $7,000 plus an additional amount of $0 to $20,000 based on the county veteran population, as well as allowing the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Offices to be eligible for a $50,000 grant instead of a $2,500 grant, which is in the governor's proposal. So these funding differences total different appropriation amounts. The governor's budget would allow $595,000 to be appropriated for the grant program, whereas Representative Newton's bill would appropriate $1,005,000.
That's where I that helps answer the question.
That's a different perspective than what I have. Some more. Representative Denver.
Just looking at the veterans' license plates, would that have to do with transportation finance?
Yes, that's, it's not in our division, but during conference, and that's why we had to talk. When you submitted your request to the governor and he made his supplemental changes, was there a discussion of Representative Newton's bill with what the governor was recommending?
Madam Chair, I don't recall that we had, after the February forecast, additional discussions about the dollar amount relative to that piece.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Questions? Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Ms. Coyle. Did I say it wrong? Howell. Sorry about that. And this was on page 33. It refers to the eligibility of surviving spouse or child of a person who served in the military to be able to get educational assistance. And the language is added here, only if the surviving spouse or child is eligible to receive federal education benefits. And I was just curious about that piece, if you're familiar with that. How many people would be affected who are currently eligible but would not be eligible if this language was put in?
Madam Chair. Representative, I don't have a good answer for that. That criteria is something that was essentially omitted, I think, when this bill was first put together. So this is just a piece of language that was recommended to us by Minsky to ensure that if we did, in fact, amend this to include that, because it just is a small piece of verbiage that sort of brings this up to date with how common practices are relative to the financial the monies for the school. That helps. I mean, I can certainly try to find out exactly how many families that may or may not affect. Satisfied.
Madam Chair. Representative Wills.
Thank you. And thank you for that information. It would be helpful to have that information as and who this might affect. And it sounds like you're saying that it's pretty common to make it consistent with federal language when we're doing programs like this, and that's an oversight in the past, and that's what we're trying to correct.
Madam Chair and Representative, it's not that it was an oversight, and adding this language is not going to reduce the number of people that are eligible that much. We know, but I don't know how many additional people may be able to take advantage because of this specific provision. I don't, as I recall, and we talked about this last year, as I recall the discussions with Minsky, it wasn't going to add or include anyone. It's just updating the financial piece of it.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here that wants to talk about the supplemental governor's recommendations? Is there anyone here that wishes to give advice as we begin to think of what should be in House File 1184, delete everything amendment, which will be the vehicle for the committee, state finance, state government scheduled now. Is there anyone that wants to submit advice to the committee on what should be contained in 1184 at this particular time? Deleted from. Tomorrow morning I have a bill up in Government Operations Committee at 8:15. Shouldn't take real long period of time. After that bill is done, I'm going to go back to my office. And I'm going to be there till about quarter after 11:30. If people have things that they want to, just tell me personally. Should be in or not, or what I should be thinking about, or don't forget, you may stop by. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I have a question here for Mr. Nylander. The meeting for the 19th, what day was that meeting? There's no date on the I'll move the minutes from March 18th and as printed, and March 20th as correct with the date being added to it. Yes.
Representative Nelson moves the adoption of minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Is there any other business to come before us? Thank you so much. Thank you for your cooperation. Thank you for squeezing in and sticking with us. This meeting is adjourned. See you after break.